This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's a brand new week. It's Monday, October 21st, 2019. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us on today's edition of the Noon Business Hour. Try to stay in one place. It's a gusty afternoon. The Noon Business Hour, presented by the Village of Bedford Park. The Star Wars franchise debuts a new and final trailer tonight. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, four drug companies have reached a last-minute legal settlement over their role in the opioid addiction epidemic, just as a nine-week trial was scheduled to get underway in Cleveland. We're joined now by Riley Griffin, who is a healthcare reporter with Bloomberg based in New York. Riley, welcome to the program. What are the contours of this settlement agreement?
Yeah, to put this in perspective, the opioid overdose epidemic took more than 70,000 lives last year. And these drugs have been particularly impactful in Ohio, where these two counties are located. So, however, the $260 million settlement between the Ohio counties AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, McKesson, and generic drug maker Teva does not resolve the more than 2,700 other opioid-related suits being brought forth in multi-district litigation. It really does buy them time to reach that larger global settlement.
And that is $48 billion. And even though that seems like that is an awful lot of money, if all of these individual cases were to go to trial, and if we saw the discovery process opening up the decision-making process at many of these pharmaceutical companies, the damages those companies could pay out would be a lot higher than $48 billion.
Correct. So we've seen the distributors offer $18 billion to resolve their cases. Between all of the stakeholders, it's estimated that it could cost $50 billion or more. So that makes today's settlement look like small change. We really have to ask ourselves, what can we learn from the negotiations that have been underway currently? And Wall Street analysts really seem to think that there's just going to continue to be this overhang on these stocks. One framed it to me earlier today as an equity purgatory. And we're still seeing that overhang today as McKesson, Cardinal, Teva, and AmerisourceBergen see their stocks fall.
Now, are there critics or advocates for victims, either people who are grappling with addiction or people who have overdosed over the last couple of years? Do they believe that some of the drug companies are skating as a result of these settlements?
I think you have two very different parties at play here. There are competing political and pragmatic considerations. So at the county level, the counties need money to treat addiction and overdose right now. The government, meanwhile, needs to show that they've reined in the epidemic more broadly and have beat out those distributors and drug makers, as you're saying. So when those conflicting interests come into play, that's where we're looking towards those global resolutions and seeing it a difficult process that's ongoing.
And has there been any discussion about how a opioid addiction settlement would compare to the tobacco settlement of 18 years ago?
There are constant comparisons. I think we'll have to watch and see what those similarities actually are, but you certainly can look to the other.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Riley Griffin, healthcare reporter for Bloomberg based in New York, talking about this first settlement in the first opioid trial, which was set to begin in federal court in Cleveland. But now both sides have agreed to a financial settlement with more to come. Could see a $48 billion price tag attached to the opioid crisis by the time it's all said and done. Coming up, tune in to Monday Night Football, and you'll see a new trailer for Star Wars.
The best daily deal in Chicago, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The trailer for the new Star Wars movie hits the airwaves tonight during Monday Night Football, and we're joined by Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and newmediasolutions.tv, based in Seattle, Washington. Tom, welcome back to the program. Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, opens on December 20th. The last trailer out tonight, and then your chance to buy tickets comes immediately after that trailer is released. So once again, if the Disney marketing Death Star is about to become fully operational.
Yeah, that is true. And what's always funny to somebody in television is when they push the trigger on that Death Star, it's a Grass Valley switcher. So we kind of enjoy that.
I get that joke.
Yeah, folks like us in the media. So, yeah, you know, Monday Night Football, here comes something like 13 million viewers. That's what they had for Lions-Packers last week. We'll see what they do this week. But these live sports events are one of the few chances you have to aggregate a massive national audience. And this trailer, it'll be interesting to see if this trailer is for Star Wars nerds who know all about this and the fact that this is Episode 9, or if it's tuned more to non-Star Wars people to try to tie them into the franchise. I'm going to be very interested to see it and to see how that's weighted.
This is Episode 9 of the original Star Wars saga that began with Episode 4 back in 1977. They picked it up with the prequels in 1999, and then the final three episodes started in 2015. Now, Disney has tried to branch out with Rogue One and Solo, a Star Wars story, but they have not been as successful as the original Star Wars storyline. So what happens after Episode 9 hits streaming services sometime next year?
Yeah, so that's a big question. And, you know, are they going to, if you had an ATM spitting out $100 bills in your basement, would you pull the plug on it? Probably not. Yes, this is Episode 9 of the original series. And, you know, there's always a nerd battle about which order you're supposed to watch them. I vote in favor of 1 through 9 to see it chronologically according to the saga's timeline. But you'll be bouncing a little bit, bouncing around in real time, as you mentioned there before. But after this, you know, the sequels haven't been awesome, but there's still plenty of gas in that tank. And Bob Iger told Bloomberg that there are more movies in development. There's going to be a pause, and those movies really are going to be done. There's a multi-project series that's been greenlighted apparently, or at least is in production or in pre-production with the showrunners that brought us Game of Thrones, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. So there are plans in the works. Again, that ATM is still working. There's a long tail. They don't all have to be hits, and we'll see how it goes.
Very quickly, Tom, can you name another piece of intellectual property that everyone can seem to agree on in the way that we all love Star Wars?
No, I think it's, you know, unique, and the fact that it spans so many decades and so many generations. You know, your kids' kids are just as into it as you were, and you're just as into it as the folks who read the original books were. So it's an amazing franchise, and I don't think we're going to see it come to an end anytime soon.
So the Star Wars Episode 9 trailer tonight on Monday Night Football. It's the New England Patriots versus the New York Jets, a matchup similar to the battle between the Empire and the Ewoks on Endor in Return of the Jedi, and the Ewoks won.
Loaning useful information each weekday. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
More employers are offering flexible hours these days, but in some cases, the work isn't getting done. We're joined now by Rick Cobb, Executive Vice President, Challenger Gray and Christmas, based in Chicago. Rick, welcome back to the program. Let's kind of set up the issue here, and it sounds like the idea of flexible hours was designed on two fronts. One, to get the edge in a competitive job market, and two, find a way to recruit college graduates as they were leaving school.
Yeah, I think that is partially true. I would also add improved productivity as a byproduct when it's done, when you pick the correct people and you have the right environment for it. So, sure, you want to keep talent or attract talent, and you create an environment which is, I guess, more hospitable, a more positive environment for the people that that do that work, and remote work is a part of that.
And what were some of the reasons why working remotely or setting your own hours, what made that attractive to people?
A lot of the work that needs to be done now is intellectual. You know, back in the day, a big six consulting company, you'd go to the office, the customer, and you'd be there at 6 a.m. You'd stay at the hotel across from the parking lot. You'd stay there till midnight. You'd be there at 6 a.m. again. But that work, much of it was physical. You were walking down the hallway, pulling file drawers out, asking people questions. Much of that job, and many of those data analysis jobs now, are jobs where you have the laptop, you have the information, And your job then is to basically think for the entire time you're there. It's not humanly possible for people to think that hard that many hours in a row. And it doesn't require that you be sitting in an uncomfortable environment in somebody else's office without the other things that make your job easier, just so that the customer feels better.
And what happened with some of these flexible hours arrangements, and why do they fall apart?
You know, I think we've forgotten the fact that a bad hire is a bad hire. And when you hire somebody that's a poor fit, either by background, personality, or function, or just behavior, it's easier to one, identify it when they're not around, and two, for them to hide from the flaws and mistakes when they're not in the office. So it's critical when you make the decision to allow employees to work remotely that you have people, one, that can do the job, and two, that they fit into that environment. There's another thing that happens. So generally, people are, if you want to take the total survey of people that work remotely, they tend to be between 13 to 15% more productive than the average employee. There's no water cooler talk. They're not having to commute. They're not dealing with what they're wearing, what they should and shouldn't wear, what time they have to be able to go to lunch, a lot of the things. And they can work longer hours. Many people that are good employees, you have to almost watch for burnout because they'll work more hours than they should rather than less. Of course, the opposite's true. You know, the bed, the refrigerator, and the television can be the enemy of productivity. But that's something that you have to manage by having communication and access to the employees. So it's about that. The other thing that's a hidden danger is beyond people who actually burn themselves out is just flat loneliness. We are social animals, and there are certain people and certain jobs where the person can't work by themselves. They feel a little lost, or the work that needs to be done has to be more collaborative. The one situation that was cited with the design engineer, I would say that was a bad hire, only because that job had to be in the manufacturing environment because the people that needed to get the information need to make corrections to the designs as they're working on it in the manufacturing environment. So if you're careful about it, it's actually better for your organization, and it allows you to keep and retain talent that you otherwise couldn't get.
Rick Cobb, Executive Vice President, Challenger Gray and Christmas, thank you for joining us this afternoon on WBBM.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The markets are trading higher. We'll see what's moving Wall Street. The owners of the United Center talk about how they've kept the arena relevant for over 25 years. A visit with our Monday afternoon stock picker, and more than 300,000 Chicago public school students get another day off as contract talks continue between the teachers union and the nation's third largest school district. WBBM Business, Markets and Positive Territory. The Dow now up 25 points. Make that 27. The NASDAQ is up 68. The S&P 500 is up 17. AccuWeather says cloudy and windy. A couple of showers today. A high near 65. Right now we have 61 degrees under cloudy skies at O'Hare. A south wind at 21 miles an hour, gusting to 35. The Noon Business Hour continues, presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Stocks are trading slightly higher this afternoon. And joining us now with the latest and what's moving Wall Street is Vahan Janjigian, Chief Investment Officer at Greenwich Wealth Management in Greenwich, Connecticut, and even the author of the book, Even Buffett Isn't Perfect. Vahan, welcome back to the program. Monday afternoon now, and it seems like investors are agreeing with earnings season, and they still like what they're hearing out of the trade negotiations with China.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen this happen a number of times in the past. Every time things look good for trade, we see the markets rally very strongly. When things look bad, the markets sell off. But we are in the midst of earnings season, and so far we've seen some pretty good reports, so I think that's giving stocks a boost.
Now, there have been a number of indicators, data points that have said that there is a recession on the horizon or an economic downturn. Is there anything out of earnings season that would bear that out, or is it just more numbers and more data for investors and observers to digest?
Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that a recession is always on the horizon. We will always have the next recession. This is part of the business cycle. The question, of course, is when. I think right now the economic indicators look pretty good. The earnings look pretty good. So I don't think that we will see a recession anytime in the near future. But certainly, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, we will have a recession because we haven't had one in quite a while, and we're due. But so far, the economy looks like it's slowing, but it doesn't look like it's in danger of going into contraction.
And the trade negotiations with China, it seems like there are good days and there are bad days. There are days like this where it sounds like both sides are making progress, and then the president tweets something about how we're raising tariffs unilaterally or something that could throw that progress off the track. Is that cycle seems to be repeating itself right here?
Yes, it does. In fact, I'd say one of the biggest risks for any investor right now is tweet risk. We have no idea what the president will tweet next, but we do know that his tweets have a big impact on the market. We've seen it time and time again. The markets react very strongly to that. Now, of course, every time we see weakness in the market, the president likes to blame the Fed and says that the Fed should be lowering interest rates more aggressively. In my view, I think interest rates are already low enough. If the market goes lower, I don't think that's the Fed's fault. You know, chances are it'll be something to do with trade, something to do with the economy, or something to do with a tweet that the president sent.
Last week, the earnings season got off to a strong start. Some banks and some tech companies reported stronger than expected earnings. But next up on deck are the companies that make things, from big things like cars and airplanes to things like hamburgers. McDonald's, Ford, Boeing, Caterpillar, they're up next. If we are going to see any trade-related weakness, is that where it's going to be found?
Well, yeah, I think that's very likely. The auto companies in particular are very susceptible to international trade problems. So, so far, earnings season has been very good, but we're really at the beginning of earnings season. We haven't really gotten into the thick of it yet. And as you pointed out, there are going to be a number of very important companies that will be announcing soon, and those announcements could have a big impact on the market. And I do expect those announcements to be much more mixed than what we've seen so far. So far, the numbers look pretty good, but we will see some companies report some disappointing results, and that could cause a bit of a sell-off.
Now, are there some kitchen table companies that could serve as bellwethers of how the American public perceives the economy? Let's say McDonald's comes in lower than expected, or other restaurant companies that indicate that people are less willing to spend money on food or nights out. Is that enough to say, okay, there might be something happening here?
Well, anything to do with consumer spending, I think, could have an impact on the stock market because our GDP is approximately 67% of the GDP is approximately due to consumer spending. So if we were to see companies that really rely on consumers, retail companies in particular, reporting disappointing results, that could have an impact. Now, keep in mind, retail is really a special case these days because even though a lot of retailers are reporting disappointing results, it's not because the economy is slowing. It's because they're losing sales to companies like Amazon. So Amazon is certainly a company that could have an impact on how the market performs. You know, we've kind of morphed over the years from these traditional companies to more of these technology-related companies. People like to think of Amazon as a technology company, but it really is a retailer, and it also has this big cloud business now. So Amazon has become the big bellwether as far as I'm concerned. And if we see good results out of Amazon, the market should hold up. If things are not looking so good there, then we could see a big sell-off.
Vahan Janjigian,
Chief Investment Officer with Greenwich Wealth Management based in Greenwich, Connecticut. Thanks for joining us this afternoon on the Noon Business Hour.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The owners of the United Center are revealing secrets about how they've kept the arena fresh for over 25 years. We're talking to Danny Ecker, reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Danny, welcome back to the program. 25 years ago, Bulls Chairman Jerry Reinsdorf and the late Bill Wirtz cut the ribbon on the brand new United Center on Madison, across the street from the old Chicago Stadium. And since then, the neighborhood around it has developed in ways that even the most sunny optimist couldn't have imagined back in August of 1994. You just recently talked to Reinsdorf and Rocky Wirtz for Crane Chicago Business, and they're still trying to make that building relevant for the next 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about it, in today's day and age of sports facilities, 25 years is somewhat long in the tooth when you think about the life of some of these sports arenas. I mean, it's a very interesting thing that now they're trying to develop the campus sort of around the United Center to make it more of a destination. They've added some of the new training facilities for the Bulls and Blackhawks in the last few years, and a new atrium and office building next to the United Center. You know, this has all been trying to kind of adapt to this new trend of new arenas and stadiums being part of larger mixed-use developments that are entertainment complexes. And, you know, transforming the area around it has not been easy. It has not happened overnight, but now you got Fulton Market District and the West Loop kind of coming closer to the United Center, and it's teed up for a lot of interesting opportunities for them. And we had an interesting conversation just about where they were when they would initially struggle just to finance the construction of the United Center, because the economics of the leagues was much different then than it was today, and how they've kind of been able to adapt and make sure it stays relevant, and so they don't have to tear it down and build a new one.
Well, Danny, I'm a White Sox fan, and I can recite in my sleep the tortured history that brought New Comiskey Park into the world in 1988. And I can also get very defensive about criticisms of that ballpark. And yet, the UC came along 4 years or 3 years after New Comiskey opened in 1991, and its development wasn't nearly as controversial. And one can argue it was better received than the new Sox Park when that opened in 1991.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with the financing, right? So, you know, that's one thing that Jerry Reinsdorf and Rocky Wirtz love to remind everyone, is that in an era where, you know, public financing of arenas and stadiums was, you know, the thing to do, that they put up the money to build it themselves. And there were certainly some, you know, very, very important contributions in terms of the public, concessions you could call them, with a property tax calculation that the legislature passed in 1989 to make sure that their property taxes would be capped effectively. There was a lot of different, public efforts that were made to make this thing happen and help try to revitalize the Near West Side. But, you know, has been one thing that they've, I think, been able to avoid the spotlight of people saying, well, it's a publicly owned facility, you need to, you know, there's a lot of scrutiny around that, and this is something that they've been able to put a lot of money into it, and certainly seen some of the returns from making this a privately owned, privately developed facility that they don't have to deal with, public coffers in any way.
And very quickly, Danny, it seems the struggle now is because the neighborhood has developed so quickly, is to the UC has to kind of keep up with all the other venues that have sprung up around it.
Well, sure. If you think about Wrigley Field in that area, and what's happened around with the redevelopment around the ballpark there, it's become a destination on, you know, non-game days and out of season to some degree. And I think that's what in our conversation with the owners and their sons and Michael Reinsdorf and Danny Wirtz, when they talked about the future in the next 25 years of the United Center, I mean, that's their what they need to try to do. They've got a sea of parking lots around the venue, and they want to make it more of a destination so that people will actually want to come and hang out, show up earlier, stay later, and even come out when there's no events at the arena.
Danny Ecker, Crane Chicago Business, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Join us at this time tomorrow for Travel Tuesday, and still to come, a visit with our Monday afternoon stock picker.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday toward planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Stock Picker Monday, and joining us with a pair of investment ideas is Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecast Newsletter based in Hammond. Chuck, welcome back to the program. A couple of biggies are your stock picks for the day, and your first one, Chuck, the makers of B-2 bombers, surveillance drones, spy satellites, and kind of an unorthodox pick given the defense sector these days.
Well, you're right. That pick is Northrop Grumman. The symbol is NOC. The stock trades for about $351 a share. It's down about 8% from its 52-week high, and a large portion of that pullback occurred recently. I think that Wall Street soured a tad on defense stocks here recently with the White House decision to pull out of Syria. I guess there's some thinking that that could lead to additional withdrawals from other areas of the globe, and that wouldn't necessarily be good for the defense stocks. I think those types of fears are overblown. I think you're going to see the defense sector continue to be well-funded. Northrop Grumman has outperformed earnings expectations, analyst expectations, over the last four quarters. We think that trend is going to continue. And we think, quite frankly, the environment is right for the group to stage a nice little rebound here. So we think investors should be taking advantage of the pullback. And again, we like Northrop Grumman, symbol NOC, and the trades are about 351 right now.
And the next one, another big dog in the world of finance.
That's right, J.P. Morgan, Chase, symbol JPM, stock trades for about $123 a share. You know, banks have been a group that's been pretty sluggish, quite frankly, over the last 12 months as investors have been concerned about, you know, declining interest rates, which impacts their net interest margin, loan demand, a softening economy, which potentially could crimp demand as well. All those things have been factored into a group that's really underperformed for the last 12 months. However, J.P. Morgan really put a nice jolt into its stock here recently with their company's third quarter earnings, which beat expectations and really kind of was a nice catalyst for a bump in the stock. And in fact, the stock's just recently gone through to a new 52-week high at $123 a share. Yet we still think there's value there. The yield is 3%. I think the earnings trends are still favorable. The company has a lot of different avenues to make money, so it's not solely dependent on one or two revenue streams. And I think that that's one of the reasons we think it's kind of the blue chip in the bank space. So, again, we're fond. Our companies, our investors own both of these stocks. And we especially like J.P. Morgan Chase right now, $123, symbol JPM.
The two selections this week from Chuck Carlson, Northrop Grumman, NOC, J.P. Morgan Chase, JPM. Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecast Newsletter. Thank you for joining us this afternoon on the Noon Business Hour. If you missed any part of today's show, go to our stream and just rewind to the time you want. We have a brand new pause and rewind function that works both online and by updating the radio.com app.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.